You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On this month's episode, we talk to literary translator and author of 50 Sounds, Polly Barton, local book blogger Kitty Winks about the International Man Booker Prize, literary scout Soraya Bazawi, and Rufus Purdy, founder of the brand new Brighton-based literary agency Two Peers. We also hear about the Page Turner Awards, which are open now for submission. I'll be discussing this month's book club book, The Faces by Tove Did-Levison, with local book lover Laura Mugridge. As always, you can get in contact with us on Instagram at btnbookclub or email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. If you haven't already subscribed to the Brighton Book Club podcast, you can do so on all good podcast platforms and hear previous shows. Enjoy the show. I am joined in the virtual Brighton Book Club studio by book blogger extraordinaire Kitty Winks. Kitty, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much for having me back. I can't believe how long it's been.
So we last spoke on the podcast in May about lockdown recommendations, and that honestly feels like a million years ago, but also kind of like yesterday.
Absolutely.
So how have you found the kind of Bookstagram community through lockdown? Like, has it been something that's become more important to you in isolation?
Yeah, 100%. I think all blogging communities have sort of felt it generally in times like this, because I think everyone has found solace online in terms of connecting with new people and having new people to talk to and having discussions that we wouldn't typically have on a day-to-day basis. And I think in book blogging specifically, you know, so many people over the last year have turned to reading as you know, an escape from the realities of day-to-day life. So that's meant more and more people are joining Bookstagram every day. There's new conversations happening, people are more open to speak to new people. So it's really come into its own for sure.
Since we last spoke, what is a book that you've read that you would really, really recommend to anyone listening?
I mean, it's had a lot of airtime on your show already, but it's undoubtedly Boy Parts by Eliza Clarke. That was one of my... Definitely one of my top books of last year. It's not the kind of book I normally go for. I don't typically read books set in contemporary England that often, but I think I hate it in reviews when people say that a book pushes boundaries, but there's literally no other way to describe Boy Parts. It was unlike anything else I've ever read. And I think the way it sort of looks into our perceptions of sanity is not something that's done a lot. How I've sort of been describing it to my friends as millennial American Psycho, and I think that just sort of epitomizes it perfectly.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, I love that book. And if you are listening and you maybe haven't heard the book club before, go back and search the Brighton Book Club podcast, and we've got an exclusive interview with Eliza Clarke on the show talking all about Boy Parts. So we are talking about books in translation this month. So what are your favourite books in translation? And also, we've spoken about the Man Booker Prize quite a lot, and you're a really big fan of the International Man Booker Prize, is that right?
I think we all sort of know there's a deep-rooted issue in publishing in terms of diversity and books that are being published generally, but with that also books that are sort of being pushed and marketed in a commercial way as well. And the International Prize gives a platform to a lot of books that wouldn't typically have that sort of platform, unfortunately. And what I also love about the International Booker is it gives a lot of recognition to the translators as well, who are so frequently overlooked.
Absolutely. Can you speak another language, Kit?
Absolutely not.
If you could, what language would you love to be able to speak?
I'm quite a practical person, so I think I'd probably choose Arabic, because it's so widely spoken across the world and by so many different countries. So yeah, I think I'll probably choose Arabic, not one to pick the easy options.
So yeah, of course, why would you? What are your top three favourite books in translation that you would recommend to us?
Right, so number one is actually my most recent read, and that's Slum Virgin by Gabriella Cabezon Camara, and it's translated by Francis Riddle. So this book is set in a shanty town in Buenos Aires, and it follows a transvestite prostitute called Cleopatra, and one day the Virgin Mary comes to her, and she decides to basically transform her entire shanty town. And then our protagonist is a journalist who hears of the story, immediately wants to go and follow it, and sort of the relationship that her and Cleopatra develop. It's one of those books, again, it's very unlike anything else I've read before. You've just sort of got it, you've just got to let the book sweep you up and just take you on its journey and just go with it and ride with it. It's completely chaotic, but in the best possible way. The narrative is non-linear and it has an almost like dreamlike feel, but it deals with a lot of important topics like class and politics in South America as well, but definitely a trigger warning for a lot of graphic violence in that one. And then my second pick would be Strange Weather in Tokyo by Hiromi Kawakami, which is translated by Alison Markin Powell. So this one follows our protagonist and she is in a bar in Tokyo one evening and she bumps into one of her old high school teachers. The two of them get talking and they decide to meet up more and more, and it's sort of just generally about the development of their relationship. More than anything, I sort of like a book that's quite slow paced and quite character driven with not much plot, and this is definitely that sort of novel. It's about the two characters involved, the slow development of their relationship and the forms that takes. For me, I'm always really tentative going into books where there is an age gap relationship where the male is older than the female, because it's handled in some appalling ways by a lot of male authors, but in this instance it's handled really delicately and appropriately, and it was a real joy to read, and just a really engaging, refreshing book is how I'd describe it. And finally, it's actually a short story collection, and that's Things We Lost in the Fire by Mariana Enriquez, and that's translated by Megan McDowell. So this is not only one of my favourite short story collections ever, but one of my favourite books ever. This collection is absolutely phenomenal. So again, it's set in Argentina, and they are gothic short stories. Some of them have explicit horror elements, others are just more slowly eerie, if that makes sense. I think with short story collections, it's so hard to find a collection where every single story is a five-star read, and that is completely the case with this collection. There is not one dud in this collection. I read it when it came out, so like 4 or so years ago, and I still think about it all the time, and everything is so vivid in that collection. I'd say if you like the books of Samantha Schweblin, this is definitely the sort of collection for you, and she actually has another short story collection coming out in April, which I'm very excited about.
Amazing. So for anyone that wants to recap on those titles, I will pop them on the show notes on the podcast, and we will also post that on Instagram. So Kit, how can we find and follow you and see what you're up to and what you're reading at the moment?
So my handle on Instagram and Twitter is kit_read.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Polly Barton, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Your book, 50 Sounds, is out next month with Fitzcarraldo Editions. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for having me on. So 50 Sounds is a relatively tricky book to describe, even though I sort of feel like what it's doing is very simple. It's essentially a record of my learning Japanese. So I went out to Japan when I was 21, not really speaking a word of the language, and started learning. And, you know, here I am, goodness knows how many years later, I still don't do that calculation, working as a literary translator. Through 50 different words, which are the 50 sounds, it kind of provides a record of my learning of the language. The learning of it was very much the opposite experience to learning a language through a textbook. You know, I was out there and I was speaking to people and kind of very much learning it in quite a somatic, emotional way. And so that's really where the thought for this book came out of, I suppose, is, you know, wanting to present a picture of this, a different form of language learning to, I think, the one that we most commonly think of when we talk about or hear about people learning a language.
Polly, I'm going to ask you to read an extract, please.
Absolutely. Yes. Okay, here we go. So this is from the preface to the book. Immersion in a foreign language is a bombardment of sounds until you decide that you are actually going to do this thing and learn. And then it becomes a bombardment of imperatives. Learn this, learn that, learn this. Just start from the basics, sings a voice in your head as you are tossed around in the waves of incomprehensibility. Yet as you continue to live in a language you don't know, it becomes increasingly obvious to you how much this category of basics could theoretically encompass. Greetings and everyday interactions are, of course, basic, and there is always something embarrassing about not knowing basic forms of verbs. Everyone knows numbers are incredibly basic, as are colours, clothes, the subjects you study at school, animals, anything to do with weather, and adjectives for describing people. In fact, we could go ahead and say that every object is also basic, and there is something particularly alarming when you don't know how to say the first words you would have learned in your language or languages as a child. Teddy, buggy, shoelace. And then there is the most fundamental seeming vocabulary of all, abstract nouns like justice, friendship, pleasure, evil, and vanity. If the language in question has a writing system different from that you know, then even mastering the basics of the spoken language isn't enough, because a whole new category of basics awaits you in the form of the written one. In particular, Japanese is the gift that keeps on giving in this regard, having as it does three different scripts, two phonetic ones, katakana and hiragana, collectively known as kana, with 46 characters apiece, and then the kanji, or characters of Chinese origin, 2,136 of which have been officially deemed in common usage. Which means there is never any shortage of basics to trip you up and convince you of how little you know.
It's such a good book, Polly. It's so interesting. I'm absolutely loving it. So the book starts with a long list of sounds in the Japanese language. Can we have three of your favourites?
Oh, yes. Chapter headings take the form of one particular onomatopoeic word, followed by an extremely subjective definition or description. Jin jin, the sound of being touched for the very first time. Kira kira, the sound of a hashtag magic life, or embracing your shining future. And then shobo shobo, the sound of persistent dribble. So, not dribble, persistent drizzle on a 13th century Scottish castle.
So you are now a literary translator. What's the process of translating a book in as condensed version as you can?
Well, the most condensed version that I can is really, there isn't any typical way that it happens, you know? Like I've translated six books so far, and each one has come to me in a totally different way. And, you know, sometimes it's the author who approaches, sometimes it's me who finds the book and approaches a publisher, sometimes it's the publisher who gets in touch with me from England, sometimes it's from Japan, you know, like really it runs the whole gamut, I guess. Although the task itself of, you know, ingesting this text and really finding a voice for it in English is relatively unchanged.
You won the Fitzcarraldo Essay Prize for an essay that I believe was the starting point for 50 Sounds. How did that lead to publication?
Well, so actually it's a slightly misleadingly named prize. The essay prize is actually for a book length essay. So how it works is you pitch a proposal for a full length essay book. So I pitched 50 Sounds, and I included a sample. I actually had written three of the chapters. So I included those in my pitch as a writing sample. And I was named the winner. And so I was then invited to, given a contract by Fitzcarraldo Editions, and invited to write the book in, you know, in whatever time frame I felt like I could manage.
Right, okay. And this is not a small book. It's did you find yourself just writing and writing, you know, was it longer than you thought it would be, or did you discover more things along the way?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And you know, the version that you are currently holding is considerably condensed from what it was originally. Like I couldn't seem to stop. And I guess also because, you know, a really key part of the concept with this book was that it needed to be made up of 50 essays. You know, that already generates quite a lot of volume. I mean, in the end, I ended up including a few essays that are really just, you know, a single paragraph long, and that cut things down a bit. But yeah, it was an incredibly rich topic, I felt. And, you know, the more I got into one aspect of it, the more other kind of things that I wanted to cover would pop up. I felt like I could have written twice as much, honestly.
It would have been about 1,000 pages then.
Yeah.
So, Polly, if you could translate any book to Japanese from English and from English to Japanese, what would they be?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't translate into Japanese because I just don't feel like I can really do it justice. You know, Japanese is not my native language. But that said, of course, if I could translate any book, it would be my book. because that's the only one I feel like where I have some kind of advantage over other people. The book, well, there's a book that I am obsessed with the idea of translating, which is a book called Kokuhaku by a Japanese author called Machida Ko. And that is pretty much double the length of this one. It's about 860 pages in the original Japanese,
wow.
All written in extremely heavy dialect. And it's the kind of retelling of a massacre that happened in the beginning of the 19th century. It's totally wild and absolutely wonderful. But, you know, publishers are not exactly leaping to to publish a 900-page Japanese book. So, that's on the back burner for the moment.
Well, you never know.
You never know, exactly.
Are there books, Polly, that inspired you to be a translator?
To be a translator? I don't know if there are specific books, actually. That's a really good question, and I've not really thought about it in those terms. I mean, I think just the love of reading and the act of reading and how much I get from it really has inspired me to be a translator. You know, I remember some of the first books that I read in English translation from Japanese, and I read them when I was a university student, and I remember they just had such a profound effect on me. Some books by Kenzaburo Oe, and also Haruki Murakami at the time I was really into, and it really did feel like they were offering a window onto a quite different world. And so, I suppose in a way that stayed with me. And then once I learned to read in Japanese, it was like, right, what's the next step? I guess it's translated.
So, Polly, how can we find and follow you and buy a copy of 50 Sounds?
Well, it is out on April the 14th from Fitzcarraldo. So you can look at the Fitzcarraldo website, where there should be links to people who are selling it. I mean, I think it's also available in all good local book stores and on Waterstones and so on and so forth.
Amazing. Good luck with the book, Polly, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
Welcome, Soraya Bazawi, to the Brighton Book Club. Soraya is a literary scout here in the UK. Soraya, please can you introduce yourself and tell us what a literary scout is?
Yeah, of course. Hi, everyone. I'm Soraya Bazawi. And as Anna was saying, I'm a literary scout. And a literary scout is basically a person who is paid by foreign publishers to know everything that's going on in publishing in the UK. You read a lot of things that are published in the UK or going around between agents and editors, and you report them based on your clients' tastes in foreign countries. Sometimes that can also be TV and film clients. It's basically so that they don't have to wade through everything that is being sent out or published or read, and you find what you believe is a gem that suits their list or suits their taste, or you think that would be a big bestseller in their country.
So it's a bit like being a kind of filter meets a spy meets a matchmaker.
Yes. Yeah, that's actually a really good one. That's a really good one. Yeah, I sometimes actually say it's like when people describe Gretchen Wieners in Mean Girls, when Damien's like, she knows everybody's business. She knows everything about everyone.
Yeah, exactly. But it's quite a hidden part of publishing. So we were just saying this before we hit record, that we know about editorial and we know about agents and we know about publicity and even rights. But scouting is, it's quite secretive, really, because I guess there's competition. And it's right, isn't it, that you can only work for a publisher in a territory. So you wouldn't have more than one big German publisher, because then they would be competing with each other. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's basically one client per country for each scout. That's how it pretty much works. So that, as you said, there's no competition or there's no conflict of interest for anyone.
So what territory that you scout for buys the most in translation?
So for the most part, Germany and Italy are quite big markets just in general. They they love UK books, they love US books, and it's a lot of stuff is very popular over there. So it's quite a big market for anyone, really.
So this month on the Book Club, we are talking all about books in translation, and it would be really good to know what your favourite books in translation are and your favourite books in translation that your clients have bought and translated.
So I'm actually a really, really big fan of East Asian translated books. For the ones that I've read, I think East Asian writers have a really sort of beautifully poetic but understated way of writing about life and writing about relationships. And it's always, I always feel very content and relaxed when I read their stuff, even if it tends to be dark themes. It's always done very hard-hitting but softly. It's the last ones that I read was Braised Pork by Un Yu. That's published by Penguin in the UK. Really, really beautiful. It's got magic realism in it, and I felt like I was dreaming the whole time I was reading it. That was my last favorite one. There's also a book by a French author that's been translated everywhere because she is absolutely fantastic. Her name's Nina Bourouaoui. I said that the way I would my Moroccan name, because she's Algerian, and she's a French Algerian author, and she wrote a really, really incredible memoir called All Men Want to Know. And it's like, it's quite stream of consciousness and based in like very short memories, and it goes back and forth between her childhood in Algeria and after she immigrated to France, and where she comes to terms with her sexuality and being a lesbian. And it breezes over being a lesbian in the times of the AIDS crisis as well in France, and how it wasn't really spoken about among lesbian women. And it's absolutely beautiful writing. I really love it when translators get the essence of the writer's voice really down perfectly. Again, it's a really beautiful book to read.
Amazing. I will make sure that we put that recommendation in the show notes for today and on Instagram. One more question about scouting, Soraya. What trends have you noticed in different territories? What countries buy more of what?
Do you know what? It's kind of hard to say, because what may be selling now to publishers won't become a trend until a year later when they're all actually published. So it's in a way it's good, because then you know what's coming and what's going to hit the market, but it changes that quickly. So they're all bought all in like one big go, say around Frankfurt Book Fair, and then they're not published until 2022 or 2023, and then by then what's being bought again is a completely different trend. A lot of sort of stuff about relationships, and personally what I've seen being published now, and what I've liked to see as well, is a lot that's centered around female agency and female sexuality. And as we've seen, because of everything that happened with the protests last summer, there's a lot of books that are centered around racial identity and racial discrimination and systemic racism.
When I was scouting, I remember there was this massive trend for books with girl and sister in the titles. And
oh yeah,
the thriller, that was, oh my gosh. And they all merged into one in the end.
Oh yeah, they do. I found that a lot with with some thrillers, it was always the girl in the window or the girl at the door or the girl next door, or there was always a wife in the title. The second wife, the third wife, the secret wife. But again, it's like it's a form of marketing, which I completely understand, because then it's easier for like the everyday reader to look at a title and like associate it to that theme.
Yeah.
So if they already like stuff like the girl in the window, they're automatically gonna see a title like that and a cover similar to that and know that it's something that they would probably like to read.
Absolutely. So Sarai, you are also a freelance writer and journalist. How can we find and follow you and read some of your work?
I pretty much tweet all my articles. That's the best place to find me. It's at Halal Takeaway. the second L is a double L because just the normal spelled Halal Takeaway was already taken. So it's H-A-L-A-double-L and then Takeaway.
Was it taken by Halal Takeaway?
No, it wasn't. I can't remember who it was, but when I tried to save it, it said it was already taken. So I went with the misspelled version. But yeah, I pretty much operate mostly on Twitter. So everything I post is on there. Or you can find it if you just search my name with The Stylist or with Aurelia Magazine, who are places that I've written for previously.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Rufus Purdy, literary agent, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Please, can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, I'm Rufus Purdy. I live in Brighton, actually. I live in Hove, actually. I've been here since 2012 when I moved down with my family. And the reason I moved down to Brighton was because I was completely freelance and, it seemed like a lovely idea to live by the sea. We had very young children. And then, of course, what happened straight away was that I then got a job in London. So I joined, you know, thousands of people every morning at Hove Station going up to London. And I worked for the Curtis Brown Literary Agency. I was working for Curtis Brown Creative, which was the agency's novel writing school, and also as an editor at Curtis Brown Agency itself. I was working on their digital imprint Studio 28, working with lots of authors there. And then when I left Curtis Brown in 2018, I decided that what I wanted to do was set up novel writing courses and take them outside of London. And I felt, I think, towards the end of my time at Curtis Brown, that though the courses we were running were absolutely fantastic and loads of the writers on them went on to get book deals, I felt that we essentially were running courses that cost £3,000, you know, or £1,800 for an online version. And that wasn't really accessible to a lot of people outside London who weren't on London salaries. So I took those courses outside London and we took them to Manchester, Birmingham, Belfast, Edinburgh, and actually fairly recently to Brighton. And they were kind of very successful, but then of course the pandemic came along. So I started running online courses as well. And that's also been very successful. But as well as running online courses, ever since I left Curtis Brown, I've been working as a freelance editor. So people have been sending me their novels and sometimes children's books as well. And I've been doing editorial reports on those. I've been doing copy edits. You know, I offer a full range of editorial services. But several of the writers that I worked with, these were incredibly good writers writing great stories told in a fresh and original way. So what I would do is I would work with them to edit their work till it's as I would work with them to get their work in the best shape possible. And then I would use my contacts to set them up with literary agents. And I suppose towards the end of that, I started getting a bit sick of sending them on to people who would then sign them, make the announcement and sell them. And there'd be a lot of fanfare. And, these were people who were often saying to me, you know, couldn't you represent me? Couldn't you do that? And for ages, I'd been saying, oh, no, I'm not a literary agent. I'm an editor. And then recently I just thought, well, why not? You know, I was working with a brilliant client whose book was absolutely fantastic, you know, and I thought, I'm the right person for this, you know, and she trusts me and wanted to work with me throughout. So I went ahead and set up the Two Peers Literary Agency, which began about 3 weeks ago, I think that was the official launch of it. And yeah, we're sort of in very early stages yet, but that novel has been submitted out to publishers. I took on another client a couple of days ago. I'm speaking to a couple of other people, and also another agent who I think is going to come and join me and help look after the non-fiction side of things. So yeah, it's exciting times.
Oh, that is so exciting. And we always need more kind of book-related things outside of London. I completely agree. And Brighton, I'm sure you know, and you're definitely about to find more, that there is such a vibrant scene here and there are so many great writers. So what are you looking for? What's your dream client, Rufus?
My dream client? Well, obviously, a brilliant writer with a really great story, you know, something that I've not heard before, something that makes me sit up and think this is, you know, this is original and fresh. But really, you know, I think it is more about the story than the writing so much. I mean, the writing, to an extent, I can sort out. But yeah, it's about stories that haven't been told or about voices that aren't usually heard. That's, you know, that's what I'm interested in.
So are you covering fiction? You said you're going to get someone in for not fiction, adults books, children's books. Do you have a niche, or are you still kind of exploring that?
I don't have a niche. And actually, you know, if you look at most agents' bios on their agency websites, they're absolutely specific about what they want. You know, they don't deal with, say, fantasy. They're looking for more dark crime, but not necessarily cozy crime, things like that. For me, it's just about the story. You know, I've always read eclectically. You know, looking at my bedside table at the moment, I've got a copy of the Old Testament. I've got the new David Mitchell book on there, and I've just bought a commercial fiction, women's commercial fiction novel that I really, really like the look of. It was, I think, it was in one of the Richard and Judy choices. So, you know, I'm not remotely snobbish about literature, or I don't only deal with literary novels or, you know, romance novels. Anything. It's, you know, it's like with music, you know, I like everything from kind of jazz to classical. If it's done well, and I can buy into that and get a reaction from it, then absolutely I can be passionate about that novel.
Oh, this is music to my ears, Rufus. So, right. So I know that you've run novel writing courses in the past, and a lot of people that listen to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb and also the podcast are writers or interested in writing. What would you say your top three novel writing tips are?
Well, the first one is stick at it. I think writers need to learn an element of stamina and self-discipline. And I think, you know, realizing that not everything you're going to put on the page is perfect. Too many writers, you know, will have this idea of a novel in their head, and they'll splurge, say, three or four chapters down, and then suddenly it's not going quite as well as they thought it would be, and they give up. You know, oh, everything I'm writing is hopeless, like, this isn't for me. You know, I think they have to realize that even professional writers think like that as well, and it's not a case of this God-given talent that's just kind of splurged out onto the page. Writing a book is a lot of hard work, and there's a lot of techniques that you need to know to do it. It's, you know, there's not that different from engineering. So, you know, you need to know what you're doing and realize that you can put things right. My second tip, I would say, is trust the edit. I think, I can't remember which writer said it, but the idea of your first draft is almost like making the clay that you then sculpt down to, you know, to finesse into the final novel. Just think of that first draft as making clay, because then, you know, there are several stages to the edit where you can refine, you can, you know, identify the scenes that are missing, scenes that don't work, you know, that can be taken out. You know, the novel that comes out at the end might be very, very different to the novel that you put onto the page, first of all. And then my final writing tip, I would say, treat dialogue as people speak. Don't put down, you know, hammy, clunky sentences full of exposition. I think, you know, think about how people actually say things and make it realistic, because a reader can see through that straight away.
And Rufus, how can people find out about you and the agency and get in touch either with their manuscripts or with their novel ideas?
Well, they can go to the website, which is twopeersagency.com, or they can, you know, or they can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. Our handle is twopeersagency. I think we're on Facebook as well. Yeah, I mean, drop us a line, you know, if there's anything you're unsure about. I think, as I said earlier, then I'm willing to accept everything. I think the only thing that I wouldn't do is illustrated children's books, you know, not that I don't love illustrated children's books, but I just, you know, that's not my experience. I don't know the market so well for that. I don't think I'd be the right agent for that. But certainly middle grade, young adult, anything up to, you know, anything beyond that, I would absolutely love to hear from writers of. And yeah, and you know, we're willing to hear from anyone who's got a really, really good story to tell. And if they're based in the Brighton and Hove area, then even better.
Thank you so much for coming on, Rufus.
It's a pleasure, Anna. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the actual book club part of the Brighton Book Club. I'm really happy to be joined by my friend and fellow Brighton resident and fellow voracious reader, Laura Muggeridge. Laura, please can you introduce yourself and tell us how you're keeping at the moment?
Hello, Anna. I am Laura. I'm a theatre maker, writer and performer. And yeah, I'm in Brighton and I'm all right, I think, today. I'm going on a day by day basis when anyone asks me that. Excitingly, I wrote a piece of telephone theatre in between the two lockdowns with two other writers in Brighton. And we've just found out it's going to be touring for 12 weeks, so touring whilst not going anywhere. So that's been really nice news that's really perked me up.
Congratulations. What's telephone theatre?
It's you sign up through various different, there'll be different venues that sort of take it on to sort of sign up to it for a week, and then you sign up for a slot, and then over the course of an hour you will receive four phone calls from two different people. And it will feel at the beginning like you're being called from a call centre, but you realise quite quickly there's something else going on at the call centre. So you sort of become involved in the story of two characters that call you. And I'm really proud of it. It's been really lovely to be working on something creative throughout lockdown. And it's so good that it's been supported and it's been funded, thank goodness. So we can start touring with it in March.
That is so exciting. We'll have to get you to tell everyone how they can find out more at the end of this piece.
Definitely.
So, Laura, you are a big reader.
I am.
What have you read in the last few months? Because also you're really good on nonfiction, which I'm not as good on. And I'd love to hear some recommendations from you.
Well, I try to not make a decision about what I'm going to read next until I finish the book I'm currently reading. But it tends to be, I tend to alternate between fiction and nonfiction. I'm really into autobiographies as well. I've almost finished, but I'm reading My Dark Vanessa, by Kate Elizabeth Russell, which I am loving. I mean, it's pretty dark, but there's some very interesting points it brings up about dynamics of power and about the Me Too movement. And but I just before that, I read the Ramble book, so Adam Buxton's sort of journal, sort of. I don't know if he would call it an autobiography, but it's his musings really. And I love Adam Buxton, so that was very enjoyable to read. So I try and mix it up a bit between fiction and nonfiction.
I had the absolute pleasure last year of, as part of my day job, interviewing Kate Elizabeth Russell, and it was a real career highlight for me. She is so clever and so interesting.
I think I started like 2 days ago, and I'm on page 300. And I've just been trying to encourage my son to also read next to me so I can get as much reading as possible. I'm like, why don't we sit in bed and read instead of doing maths? And he's like, brilliant. But I'm totally using it as a way of just being able to read my own stuff.
It's absolutely gripping. But today we are here to talk about The Faces by Tove Did Leveson, which is translated by Nina Nunnally. So I'm going to read a bit of the blurb and then we're just going to chat about it for a bit. Sound okay?
Perfect.
Copenhagen, 1968. Lise, a children's book writer and married mother of three, is increasingly haunted by disembodied faces and voices. She is convinced that her husband, already extravagantly unfaithful, will leave her. Most of all, she is scared that she will never write again. Yet as she descends into a world of pills and hospitals, she begins to wonder, is insanity really something to be feared? Or does it bring a kind of freedom? And I read this really good review in the New York Times that says the fact that Leveson was herself one of insanity's inmates does much to explain this book's harrowing authenticity. But the faces in Tina Nunley's very deliberate, close to the nerve translation rises above a case study because working from the inside, Did Leveson is able to explore the surprising contours of Lisa's experience. From her point of view, madness can be funny, soft and secure, and far more enlightening than the reality it struggles to evade. And I just thought that was such an interesting and succinct review of this book, which is very raw and not always very easy to read. And I was actually very glad it was short, because it wasn't that I didn't enjoy it, but it's a very claustrophobic read, and it's very difficult at times to kind of stick with, because you get sucked into the kind of madness of the protagonist. But it was kind of dreamlike and uncanny, and I just couldn't couldn't do it, I don't think, if it had gone on any longer. That's not to say I didn't enjoy it, I really did, but the close third person narrative makes it feel very plausible and very real, and at times it was almost too much. How did you feel about the book, Laura?
Oh, I was so glad it wasn't longer. It's so interesting hearing you say that, because again, that would normally be a way of saying I hated it, I was glad when it stopped. But you're right, absolutely claustrophobic. When I think about often I assign sort of colors and textures to things when I imagine them, and when I was in this book, everything felt very grey, very clinical, very sort of shiny, just very sort of, clinical, really. And it took me a long time to get into this book. I was sort of struggling with the first chapter or so. And I was like, oh, I really hope this. And then it got me. And then I was like, oh, no, now I'm really into it. But I definitely do want it to finish, because it really got to me. I sort of wanted to finish it so it was done, because I felt like I was trapped in it. And again, this doesn't sound like a positive review, but it really is. But like there was a sentence in the very first page, actually. And now I said that I found it hard to get into, but there was a sentence in the first page when she's talking about faces, and she talks about her children, and it says they slept and their faces were blank and peaceful and didn't have to be used again until morning. And I found that image of going, my face is resting now, I don't have to use it. It really reminded me of I once asked my son to get up in the morning, and he said, sorry, mummy, my face is still closed. So I use that now with varying effects. But I loved the way that she described things. But I was sort of desperate for the book to end, but I didn't want the main character to go back to reality again. I wanted her to stay where she was, because it felt like it was safer there. We knew what that was. She knew what that was, and it was expected, whereas I felt the situation that she'd come out of was quite toxic, and the situation that she'd gone into was safe. Clinical, again, I'm using that word a lot, but that's, you know, clinical, but safe, and she knew where she was with it.
Yeah, that's so interesting you say that, because you said the word expected, and I was trying to think, like, what does all of this mean? You know, what does this seeing different faces on different people, and it's so focused on that. And I think so much of the book is about expectation, her expectation as a writer who hasn't written in a few years, and as a mother, and as a kind of standing member of society. And she's the author of children's books as well, and I think that adds another layer to the kind of inappropriateness of her madness, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's really interesting where she sort of gets a handle on, I've got to stop telling people about these voices that I hear, even though she's definitely still hearing them, but she's got a level of knowledge to know that, like, I have to stop saying I'm hearing these voices, otherwise they'll keep me here. But I definitely am. I just have to pretend that I don't. And I was like, oh, just stay there. Just stay there. It's better for you there, because of the relationships that she had with people back at home.
Absolutely. And it took me so part of the plot, and this isn't a spoiler because, you know, it says it in the blurb, is that her husband is extravagantly unfaithful. And that at the beginning, I mean, his mistress essentially is their nanny or housekeeper. I'm not sure how it's
described. Yeah, he's not doing it stealth, is he? he's really gone for it there.
And it really kind of knocks you over the head really early on, just thinking like, this is unsettling. This dynamic is strange. And then so much of her kind of issues, I'd say, throughout the book is paranoia, that just nothing is quite what it seems. But then you are so on her side. And I think by setting up that infidelity very early on, you are just really on board with her, because she is a kind of victim, but without being a kind of simpering victim.
Yeah, and he's very what I would describe as a bit gaslighty.
Yeah.
Which I know is not a word, but it should be. And so she doesn't ever really know what the reality is when she's with him, and she doesn't really know what it is either when she's in hospital, but she has more of a sense of what it is. And I'd rather her stay in hospital than go back to this awful man who immediately set up as just this, yeah, extravagantly unfaithful.
So I guess it's testament to this, to the wonderful translation of it, that it is such claustrophobic prose, and it does really suck you in.
It's so dense. Like, I think that's why I was... Not desperate for it to finish, but I was like, oof. And maybe in lockdown as well, always sort of being in the same place as well, I wonder if that added to it. So feeling a little claustrophobic myself, being inside all the time, I wonder if this played on that a little bit. I wonder if I'd, you know, taken it on a train or read it outside in a park or whatever, if that would have created a different experience.
Yeah. That is so interesting. You're very clever there, Laura.
I am very wise and clever.
So, Laura, before we go today, is there a book that you've read that's been translated from a different language that you would recommend to anyone listening, or that's really stuck out for you?
I loved Perfume. Is it Patrick Susskind? I'm not sure how you pronounce it. And that was just haunting. I loved it. It's again really unsettling, but it felt very, again, quite dense, but in a quite a smothery way. I loved that. I haven't thought about that for a little while, actually. And again, not one of those books I think I could read again. It's not like, oh, I'll dip back into that again. But that was really, I felt like that completely took over me while I was reading it. That would be my favorite.
Laura, thank you so much for coming on. How can we find and follow you and find out how to hear this telephone theatre? Hear or experience? How do you describe it?
I'd say probably experience it through the hearing it. So I'm on Twitter at Mugridge Magic, which is a name I enormously regret having set it up in 2010. Makes me sound like a magician. And I'm on Instagram at Laura Mugridge. And the best way to find out about the telephone piece is to follow me, because I'll be updating about it. But there's also the company that I worked with is called Out of Chaos. So it's Out of Chaos Theatre. And there is a whole page currently about the telephone piece, and there'll be tour dates added as soon as they're all definitely confirmed. Hopefully, I'm pretty positive there'll be a Brighton venue. Obviously, people aren't necessarily having to sign up to places where they're from because it's on the phone. But I do know that there'll be a presence of it in Brighton. And it's called Is Now a Good Time?
Thank you so much, Laura. You're
very welcome.
The Paige Turner Awards are open for entries, and I am joined by Paula Sheridan from the Paige Turner Awards. Paula, can you introduce yourself and tell us what these awards are?
Hi, I'm Paula Sheridan from Page Turner Awards. We're an awards program for writers, screenwriters, young writers, anybody who's actually got a wonderful piece of writing, a lovely story that they really want to get out there and place in front of judges and hopefully find a literary agent, if it's a writer, or hopefully find a writing mentor, or find a, if you're a screenwriter and you want to try and find a film producer to option your work for film, the awards for you as well. And we got a new award this year. We're really welcoming young writers along, and young writers between 18 and 25 to enter the awards. And also we have a book award, which is for published writers, anybody who's published, whether it's mainstream or independently published, book, you know, writers who've got a book, they can enter as well.
And how long have the Page Turner Awards been running?
This is our second year. Our inaugural awards was last year, and we were hoping last year, really, really hoping that we would maybe get one person published. I mean, it was just like holding thumbs, you know, fingers, thumbs, crossing legs, toes, everything we could, thinking, we really want to get, you know, somebody published. And Anna, we were actually, you know, we were bowled over. We had, at the end of it, the judges, you know, when the judging, all the judging was finished, we had three writers who won a literary agent, five writers won a publishing contract, six writers won a writing mentorship, and then we had 13 independent authors who won an audiobook production. And audiobook productions are very expensive for people who've self-published. It's a very expensive thing to do. So yes, second year only, but the first year we had such amazing successes that we were so excited. And of course, we're very excited to see what comes up this year.
Absolutely. So who are the judges of this year's competition, and what are you really looking for in a submission, how whatever category it is?
So the judges are across a wide spectrum. So first of all, the writing award, we have judges who are literary agents and publishers, and they are actively looking for writers to publish and to represent, to take work to publication. We have a screenplay award where we have film producers who are actively looking for writing to option. And that's obviously screenplays that they can option. And you know, whether it's a screenplay as in a film, or if it's a documentary, or if it's a TV series. Then we have four writing mentors, and they very, very kindly are offering to mentor a writer for the next year. And then we have a book award, and then we've got various prizes on that. And one of them, as I mentioned, is an audiobook production. And then we have the Young Writer Award, and that's for anyone between 18 and 25 who have written a story and would like to get it in front of judges. And again, the judges are publishers and literary agents who are looking, particularly looking for very good stories from a younger audience. And they would, you know, hopefully, you know, if somebody is really good, they will then publish that writer. So those are the judges. And in the screenplay award, we're absolutely thrilled. Amongst the film producers, we have Paul Michael Glazer, who is from Starsky and Hutch, the old Starsky and Hutch, absolutely, you know, famous TV series. So we've got Starsky as one of our judges. So we're just so, so thrilled with that. And then your other question, Anna, which was about how do they enter, is quite simple. They go along to pageturnerawards.com. On the main menu, they can see register, they can see enter. They just read the details about how to enter, which asks them to register. Once they've registered, they get a verify email. It's all the normal standard thing that they have to. We just have to check that, you know, they're not spammers. They come in. Once they've registered, they will just follow the steps. They log in and they follow the steps on how to enter the awards. They will land on a page which says very clearly how to enter the awards. And then they just follow the steps and enter and, you know, get their submission in. So, yeah, it's pretty easy. And they have from now, the awards are open now. So they have from now until the end of May, the 31st of May, the awards close. So the unique thing about Page Turner Awards is that they can enter now, or they can enter at any time up until the 31st of May. They can they can add their submission now or they don't have to. But the beauty of it is they can do any changes they want up until the 31st of May. So even if they enter their work now and they get some feedback or they get some editing done, they can make as many changes as they want before the 31st of May, because on the 1st of June, the judging starts and then they can't make any more changes. So even if they enter now and they do some writing in a few weeks' time and they think, oh, this is much better, the work that I've got is much better now, they can go back and they can edit it and change their submission. There's no problem with that. We allow them to do that.
That sounds excellent. I've never heard anyone else doing that before. Thank you very much, Paula. Good luck with the awards.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club, and thank you to all this month's guests. Join us next month for another local author special featuring Joanna Rees / Josie Lloyd, amongst others. Our book club book is Caleb Azuma Nelson's debut novel, Open Water, which is out now with Penguin and has already been reviewed by award-winning poet, playwright and novelist Benjamin Zephaniah, amongst others, calling it an amazing debut novel, a beautifully narrated, intelligently crafted piece of love that goes deep, then goes deeper. You should read this book. So if you'd like to get involved in the show, pick up a copy of the book from your library or from your local independent bookshop and read along. If you've missed any of our shows, don't worry. All the Brighton Book Club episodes are available as a podcast. Just search for the Brighton Book Club wherever you get your podcasts. Amongst others, we have episodes on crime, poetry, short stories, mental health and graphic novels, young adult books and more. You can also follow us on Instagram at BTN Book Club and email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. We consider all your ideas. If you've missed the names of any books that were recommended in the show, we'll pop them up on Instagram and in the show notes on the podcast. So take care of yourselves and we'll see you next month.